Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is October 6th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Christian?
How you doing, Neil?
You're down there closer to the nation's nerve center. Closer to the White House, which is becoming a little bit of a hazard zone. I understand that the D.C. mayor is considering that to be a leading hotspot in the virus right now. So, well, we'll see how that pans out. Also, as always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it, and among other things, you will be able to get our newswire and watch my show on COVID-19, special interviews with guests, and we've been doing a lot of those recently, and all the other things we put out. As I promised last week, this podcast will mostly feature my presentation last Thursday with JT Taylor, our political strategist here at Hedgeye, and this will be about the outlook on the 2020 election. In this discussion, we look at the current odds for the presidency, including what's going on in the battleground states. We look at how well each party is doing in the races to take the Senate and keep the House. Will the Democrats gain control of the Senate with or without the possibility of our President Biden? When will we even know the result? As we know, we have two elections in Georgia, which may not be decided until almost before the next president is actually decided in a joint session on January 6th. And speaking about knowing the result, we look at everything that could go wrong with this election, and there's a lot that could go wrong. Election counts that get delayed past the safe harbor day, court challenges over the counting of mail-in votes, and yes, the possibility of a no decision in key states that are too close to call, or of judicial conflict, or even popular unrest over state-by-state results. What does the Constitution say should happen in these cases? And what about that arcane but all-important statute, the Electoral Count Act of 1887? What does it say? And if all this results in no decision, what about the Presidential Succession Act of 1946? Will the current commander-in-chief honor the declared election outcome? Is there any chance we could get a Nancy Pelosi acting as president? It's all on the table in its own way. In this upcoming discussion, JT and I discuss all of that. But before we play this discussion, let's cover a bit of news, and maybe we should start with you, Christian, and the markets and indicators this past week.
All right. Well, let's start with the S&P 500, Neil. Over the last five trading deals, it is up 0.8%, and the global Dow is up 1.8%. Now, as for the VIX, it actually just closed as of recording this, and it came in at 29.52.
Wow.
Now, in these last 15 minutes of the day, we've actually had quite a big rise. It was in the 26 range, and this came off the news that Trump says he is no longer going to negotiate on more stimulus until after the election.
Well, a rise in the VIX usually means a fall on the market, so we know how that ended.
Yes.
And look, I mean, the market was really waiting for this. This is obviously a near-term, positive that the market was expecting. Obviously, they were expecting it, and they didn't get it. I think everyone thought that, you know, Pelosi and Trump and Mnuchin, and they're all going to kind of come together, but it didn't happen. Interesting. What about indicators?
All right. Well, at the end of last week, we got the unemployment rate for September. That fell and came in at 7.9%. But people were more interested, Neil, in the non-farm payroll. So back in August, the U.S. added 1.5 million new jobs. But for September, that number went down. We only added 661,000 new jobs. Now, this is relative to before the pandemic, adding quite a few. But you have to know that employment is still down minus 10.7 million jobs relative to the February peak. Now, let's just say we kept this rate for September. It would take us nearly 3 years to recuperate that many jobs, Neil.
Right. Well, that's that just shows you that all these economists who say it's taken us about 2 to 3 years to re-achieve normalcy, right? The level of GDP right. that we had before the recession, that's, you know, I guess that kind of jibes, right? That's kind of consistent with it. But of course, if that increment actually narrows even further, it'll take longer. And that obviously feeds into the market's disappointment just a few minutes ago about stimulus, you know, not being continued, because the one thing that was giving right. a lot of tailwind back in May and June and July was a lot of stimulus, right? A tremendous flow of federal money, and that's gradually drying up. People's unemployment is expiring. Even the makeshift deal with the states over the FEMA money is that itself is drying up. So there you go. Great. And also, since we are about to talk about the upcoming election, let me update you on some relevant political news. First, we had the presidential debate, which took place the evening after our last podcast. And I think we can all agree it was a stunning performance. And I don't mean that in a good way. I think Republican or Democrat, right? Maybe we can all agree that it signified a further lowering in our perception of the health of liberal democracy in America. Certainly the perception of the rest of the world. On the question of who won, nearly all of the instant post-debate polls gave the win to Biden. But not so much because Biden did or said anything notable or remarkable, but simply out of instinctive recoil from the tactics of Trump. I just basically think it was that simple. Afterwards, Trump supporters claimed he clearly won the debate, that all those instant polls didn't have good methodology, they were inaccurate. A week later, though, we can look at the national polls, and these show that indeed the debate clearly benefited Biden. So you remember all those hopes, right? That just wait till the debates, right?
Right.
You remember that was sort of the secret weapon. Well, the NBC Wall Street Journal poll on September 30th, October 1st, which was, you know, at a time after the debate was sunken in, showed an unusually large Biden lead of 14 percentage points. Three of six national surveys since that poll show Biden's lead in the double digits. Biden's lead in the predicted future markets is now close to 2-1. His lead in the Real Clear Politics sort of aggregated national polls is now, you know, 9%, 9.5%. It may that lead itself, right, maybe close to double digits. So that leads to my second point. Biden achieved significant further leads in the polls due to the debate. And lastly, as we all know, President Trump tested positive for COVID-19 last week, was admitted to Walter Reed Hospital on Friday, where he stayed for 3 nights and was released on Monday, or maybe I should say he released himself. I don't think the doctors are necessarily happy with that, but he's commander in chief, right? I guess he gets to say whatever he wants to do. Let's do hope that he makes a complete recovery. But in my opinion, as many doctors have actually been quoted as saying, he's not out of the danger zone. He's not out of the woods yet. And as you know, Christian, we've gone over a lot of the data on the typical trajectory of COVID-19 infections. You become symptomatic. The mean time after infection is about 3 days. That's the incubation period. And then whether or not, however symptomatic you become, and of course, some people, particularly young people, never really become symptomatic, but it's usually around 6, 7, 8, 9 days. It's right in that period where if you are going to be in trouble, it suddenly gets worse, right? And that's what we found. Suddenly the oxygenation problems develop, which people are often unaware of, and suddenly they're admitted and a real crisis starts. I wonder whether this is smart. I just wonder why they're doing that. But, he's confident. That's what he wants to do. I have no idea whether this episode will have any impact at all on the coming election, except perhaps, to distract Trump himself and the White House from efforts to re-energize his presidential campaign. And I think many on the White House staff are now testing positive. It's got to be on their minds. It's got to be a little distraction from work. Let me just comment, though, on one thing. It was widely circulated yesterday and today, a remark of President Trump's after his release from the hospital. He said, "Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life." And once again, this is a strategy of the a Republican Party of using fear of COVID-19 as a way of sort of ideological dividing America into two camps, right? One side fears it, the other doesn't, which is why we don't wear masks, we don't avoid large gatherings, we don't care much about testing and tracing, all the rest. Here's my problem with Trump's no fear remark. In and of itself, it's fine. And in fact, it's what we expect from a leader. That's what leaders should do and show. Confidence. They should not show fear. We all recall, not personally, of course, but we all recall from the history books, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's famous remark, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And I think that's certainly something we expect from leaders. But here's my problem. When leaders do this, they also acknowledge the danger inherent in the threat they're talking about. And they give us ways and means and protocols and tools with which we can rationally overcome our fears, right? It's not a binary choice between fear or fear not. I don't know. I don't know, Christian. My only example would be if my teenage daughter is afraid of driving but needs to learn to drive, well, then yes, I tell her not to allow herself to be gripped in fear. That's debilitating, right? That's a huge impairment to performance. But at the same time, I teach her the skills and methods and habits by which she can avoid the very real dangers that she faces when she does drive. I mean, you've got these objects, 2 tons of metal that are coming at a great speed and they're passing you just a few feet away. I mean, right? I mean, there is something rational there to be concerned about. So I don't just give her the keys and say, "Don't be afraid." Yeah. Anyway, I think you understand my point here. It's strange how how this has become a partisan divide instead of something we can kind of all agree on in just a more sensible way. Okay, enough of that. We're going to get on now to my discussion with J.T. Taylor. As always, thank you all for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you again next week.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for dialing into our Election 2020 call today. Before we get started, we're going to play a brief disclaimer.
Hedgeye is a Connecticut registered investment advisor. Hedgeye is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice to individuals. This research is not an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security. It is made without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice, nor does it contain any legal or tax opinions. Source information is believed to be reliable, but Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, omissions, or the authenticity of source information. The opinions and conclusions are those of the individual speaking. This report is protected by U.S. and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipients. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Hedgeye. There is a fee associated with access to this report and accompanying materials. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. By joining this call or possessing these materials, you agree to these terms. Contact sales@hedgeye.com regarding access questions.
Again, thank you everyone for dialing in. This is JT Taylor at Hedgeye Potomac here in Washington, D.C., and I'm joined by my colleague and world-renowned demographer, Neil Howe. Neil, it's only been a few weeks since we last did this, but think about this. Since then, we had a Supreme Court vacancy with the death of Justice Ginsburg, the New York Times release of Trump's taxes, and the most, think about this, the most explosive presidential debate, call it debate or debacle, in modern history. So there's still, it's October 1st, there's still 30 more days in October, so there's likely going to be another October surprise or two, 32 days until Election Day, and, you know, I think anything can and likely will happen between now and then. It is 2020 after all, but I'm not sure it's going to matter at this point. Since the announcement of Justice Ginsburg's death, the national polls have remained constant. In fact, as constant as Neil and I have seen since the springtime, and we're only seeing incremental movement on the national level and some interesting developments in the battleground states that we'll get to in a second. We're going to quickly go through our thinking on the electoral state of play, as well as the race for the Senate and the House. Incidentally, when we get to the Senate, there may be a higher level of uncertainty surrounding the outcome of the Senate and maybe a few House races, given the ballot issue and uncertainty around the outcome of the election. So more on that later. That's what we're going to finish up with. But speaking quickly of Capitol Hill, got a couple of questions before I started today about the status of the stimulus bill. Pelosi and Mnuchin, as of 15, 20 minutes ago, had not reached a deal. They're still trying to come together here and find some area of agreement. Should they not do it by the end of this week, I say the chances are very, very low. Could Trump call them back? Yes, and he may very well do so. But the next bite of the apple after that won't resurface until after the November 3rd elections and a lame duck session of Congress, where I think we all agree that the mood on Capitol Hill may be more dour than we expect. So there is a reason to be paying attention to the Senate right now. Obviously, if you're looking at a big stimulus package or the repeal of the Trump taxes, you know, look no further than a Democratic sweep to enact their version of fiscal policy and of course, a massive stimulus spend. So lastly, I'm stating the obvious here, Neil, but the closer the polls, the closer the election. And of course, the increased risk of uncertainty of a protracted or contested election week, not election day, but election week. But even worse, in my opinion, for the markets is, and Neil is going to spend a lot of time on this at the end, is the ambiguity around the potential paths to election resolution with, and don't laugh here, but the final, maybe very unlikely path being Speaker Nancy Pelosi morphing into President Pelosi. So I know that sends shivers down the backs of some investors, but that is the final temporary solution if we don't have some agreement by December. So we're going to kick off, Neil, with our electoral map.
I would just say, you know, anything could happen. The as I think we're going to show, the actual count is remarkably stable. There's actually less margin than there was, for instance, in 2016 for unpredictability when you look at the actual polls and the results coming in. But the kind of almost constitutional end runs which are emerging, particularly that are possible now, should the president kind of go with what he's been, you know, announcing, which is that, you know, fraud is everywhere and he's not prepared to accept the results. There actually are some fairly viable ways for him to open up a route to a completely open-ended decision in Washington, D.C. And we're going to be talking about that later. People will be learning about the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and why this obscure, bizarre piece of legislation may be may hold the fate of our country in its hands. So yes, yeah. I think we should go in and just cover the numbers as they now stand.
Yep. So battleground states, and just to remind our listeners today, we'll be back live on video the next presentation. But you could send us questions at qa@hedgeye.com. So quickly on the battleground states, on slides 3 and 4, what we're seeing are Biden leads in the core, what we call the core battleground states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida. Florida's been bouncing around, up one, up two for Biden, up one, up two for Trump. Michigan, North Carolina, and Arizona all show leads for Biden right now. Again, a couple of them have fluctuated and gone back and forth, as I said, such as Florida and North Carolina, but the others have maintained, at least for the last month or two, Biden leads. Again, within the margin of error, and we've seen where that's taken us in the past, but leads nonetheless. We've expanded the battleground over the course of the last couple of months to include Iowa, Georgia, Ohio, and Texas. Iowa, as you can see, is tied right now, and so it's a toss-up. Georgia has a slight Trump lead, which is surprising to me, and the most surprising to me over the past 24 to 48 hours was Biden leading in Ohio by 3.3 right now. He has been behind most of the year, and I don't think this polling has been updated since the debate on Tuesday, and Biden is spending some time there today, but that was a new one. I thought Texas, frankly, Neil, would go or turn back to blue before Ohio did, but it looks like both are in play right now, and they, especially with some of these battleground states being in the same places where we have Senate seats. Again, a lot of attention and money, and we'll talk about money in a second, is going to be focused on those states in the coming weeks. So you've seen some changes overnight, Neil, or last, I guess, 24 to 48 hours in the on predicted with on the betting odds front. Tell us what you're seeing there.
Yeah, that's just chart 5 here. You see the implied betting odds. And, you know, Biden has been gradually widening his lead after, you know, being very close in late August. And as I explained before, it's not so much that Biden is doing that much better in the polls, but he's sustaining his lead and he's up there at, you know, 50%, which it just means that Trump is running out of time. My analogy here is an option reaching its expiration date. You know, there's only so much volatility left, right? And the odds are declining that Trump can close that gap. I think what's really significant is that the last couple of days since the debate, you've seen a huge jump for Biden and decline for Trump. It's actually one of the steepest shifts we've seen over a 2-day period, suggesting that the instant polls after the debate happened, you know, which I think happened, you know, probably these polls were taken to a stunned America, right? after watching that debate, we're generally in Biden's favor, and I think that the betting odds are reflecting that. This is the first thing that you'll see responding. We won't get actual poll numbers really, you know, for the next, it'll take 7 to 10 days before that reaction starts showing up in the poll, in the, you know, Real Clear Politics average.
Yep. And then just, you know, just to finish up on the battleground states and the national race, Neil and I are both still not quite surprised, but you know, what we're talking about at this juncture of the game is undecided at, you know, probably 5 or 6%, which is smaller than we've seen historically. In fact, 538 reported that at this juncture of the race in 2016, there were still 15 to 16% of the electorate undecided. That has shrunk. So the next 32 days is all about this 4 or 5%. We've seen such polarization. I know you guys are reading and listening to this day in, day out, but we're seeing it in the poll numbers. We're seeing in every stat out there that there really is a much, much smaller universe at play, which is why time is running out for Trump than ever before. In fact, this, in the key states of Florida and Pennsylvania, a recent poll by Quinnipiac showed Florida undecided at 4 to 5%, and Pennsylvania undecided at 3%. So I thought that was pretty stunning.
That is stunning. Back in the Trump Hillary Clinton campaign, it was more like 10% plus, a really healthy percentage going for some high-profile third-party candidates who do tend to, you know, scatter to the major party candidates come election day. All of that's missing, right? So you don't have the third-party candidates. You don't have the undecided. There's not a lot to there's less to fight over. And I think that's one reason why the mainstream pollsters, I mean, Nate Silver now has, what, 78-22 odds for a Biden victory.
Yep.
The Economist is like 86% for a Biden win. They both estimate, but, and you know, I think understandably, much smaller odds of a Democrat win in the a Democratic win in the Senate, which is more like, you know, 60 to 65%, right? And I think that would be, I think that's fair.
Yep. So we're going to shift quickly to the Cook race, the Cook political report race for the Senate here on slide number 6. Just a few changes since we last spoke. Obviously, we have a Supreme Court pick making her rounds on Capitol Hill as we speak, with an accelerated confirmation process underway. It looks as if October 12th, the hearings will begin on the Senate Judiciary Committee, on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm not, you know, I don't think, neither Neil or I saw much movement because of the Supreme Court vacancy on the national race, the race between Trump and Biden. Does it mobilize one over the other? Possibly, but we're just not seeing any evidence of that. Now, I personally think that there'll be much more of an impact by the vacancy on the Senate races, in particular in Iowa and in North Carolina, where the races are tightening or very, very tight, and you might have, you know, some disenfranchised Republicans finding their way back home, and as well as in other races. But the our universe on page 7, we feel that Alabama, I could almost say beyond metaphysical certitude, that Tuberville is going to be the next senator from Alabama, barring some just absolute Democrat tsunami here. So that's the one that's going to switch from blue to red. And so in order for the Democrats to take the Senate back, they're going to have to flip 4 seats. So it looks as if 4 more. So it looks as if right now, and this is just an update from our last discussion, Colorado, Maine, and Arizona are definitely trending Democrat right now. All the polls for the past 2 months have shown, especially in Maine, the electorate in those states moving toward the Democrats there. But I believe Collins is in real trouble in that state, and the Supreme Court fight is going to make it even harder for her, I believe. The toss-ups are coming down to North Carolina, Iowa, Montana, and Georgia. We've been saying all along Montana is going to be a horse race. Bullock, the current governor of the Democrat, has pulled near even to Daines. Again, it's Daines is up slightly, as you can see on the RCP average, but that's going to come down to the wire, and we're going to get to Georgia in about 30 seconds here. But the Democrats, given if they win Colorado, Maine, and Arizona, have to pick off 2 more of these toss-ups in order to take back the Senate, and of course hold all of their seats, including Michigan, below. South Carolina, once again, Michigan, by the way, James, the race between incumbent Senator Gary Peters and challenger John James has tightened up, so it's worth watching. Again, there's going to be a lot of money, a flood of money in that state from the presidential standpoint, so that's likely to carry one candidate further than the other. South Carolina, we said this last time, and we've been saying this for a while now, it really, really is and has tightened up. In fact, on the presidential polling that just this morning that I saw, I was shocked that I saw Trump up 49% over to Biden's 48%. Neil, I don't know if you saw that. And then Graham Harrison tied at 48%. So I don't have the state of South Carolina on my presidential radar, but somehow something might be happening down there that we're not seeing. So that's worth looking at in the next 30 days. And we'll certainly be back on that one soon. But Harrison is giving Graham a run for his money. And Graham is going to be sort of tied to Trump, if he isn't already tied to Trump, as he's going to be chairman, as he is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, running these hearings for the SCOTUS nominee here in the coming week. So going to be a lightning rod on Capitol Hill. Again, Texas has tightened, and I still think Cornyn's going to tighten on the presidential side. Cornyn seems as if he has a good lead right now, so I don't see that really moving, again, unless there's a big wave there. But once again, we're going to focus on Georgia. Since we last spoke, we have been talking about the special election there, where you have to have 50.1% in order to win. Well, that includes both Senate seats, not just the special election to fill the Loeffler seat, but also to fill the Perdue-Ossoff race. Perdue and Ossoff, the Democratic challenger, are running neck and neck. And there's a Libertarian in the race right now, which is dragging votes from both of them. And so so we may potentially have a scenario, and we'll get to this in a second, in January of 2021, where there are two Senate vacancies. If we're still deciding the presidency at that point, we still may be deciding control of the Senate, because the runoff election in Georgia is not until January 5th, 2021. And again, two races could be at hand. And it looks right now that neither Perdue nor Ossoff is going to hit that 50.1 threshold. Again, 32 days left of the election. But the Libertarian is taking away market share from both of them, dropping them below 50%. Did I miss anything on the Senate, Neil?
No, the Georgia thing is fascinating. Georgia being, one of the two states that actually requires an absolute majority, and that you're right, we could have both Georgia elections being deferred to January 5th. That is the day before the joint session of Congress in 2 p.m. in the afternoon on January 6th, where they actually have to decide the presidency. That's where the Electoral College votes are actually counted by the president of the Senate. So this raises we're gonna get to that a little bit later here, but
yep,
it raises the whole idea of exactly who will be sitting and how many other races, you know, might be delayed because of the long count. Right. Just given the huge deluge of mail-in ballots. So that's yet another subplot in all this.
Yep. Another subplot. Quickly to the House. On the House side, we still see the Democrats keeping the House. The interesting development since we last spoke is that I've heard that Pelosi and the Democratic Campaign Committee is trying to expand the map. So they're seeing something out there that we're not seeing, and they're actually putting money into safe, well, maybe leaning Republican seats. And they hadn't been doing that in the past. They were just doing it more in the some of the more Republican toss-up races. So they're putting money in, leaning to safe Republican seats. And you don't throw money away if you don't see something out there. And so there's a shift that's taken place in that mindset. Again, if the election were held today, that the Democrats could potentially gain 5 to 15 seats. And that's going to have a significant impact. And we'll be talking about this through the election and post-election, a significant impact on policy in the direction that if there is a Democratic sweep, the leftward lurch of the Democrats, and how especially the House could be the tail that wags the dog. Anything there, Neil, before we shift to
other
voting?
Well, it's just taking a look at the other side of it. And again, this has to do with the horror, right? The idea of a contingent election scenario that goes to the House, right? We don't like to talk about that, but it is there in the Constitution. and it might happen. And in that case, the House votes by state delegation and D.C. does not get a vote at all. And it turns out that currently the Democrats are ahead, 26 to 23. I think, one state, I believe it's Pennsylvania, is gridlocked in terms of delegation. So Republicans win a vote in the House by state delegation, despite the fact that they're behind in total members. And according to every projection we see, the Republicans will continue to be ahead in the new Congress that starts seating January 3rd of next year. They might even pick up one. They may even pick up Iowa, so they will actually make control 27 states. In any event, on a state-by-state delegation vote, which is what we do for a contingent election, right, if we're actually voting for the president,
yep,
the Republicans win in the House. And as we'll get to in just a second, this sort of explains some of the scenarios really open to the Republican side in the event we go into that scary and uncharted waters.
Yep. So slide 9, we're going to shift quickly to early voting. And as you can see by the map, we've got, I think, probably over 10 states that are voting right now, or early voting is underway. Or mail-in ballots have already been mailed out. And by the time I think the next debate rolls around, the presidential debate rolls around on October 15th, I think you'll have almost two-thirds of the country where early voting is underway. And there are some interesting stats that we're seeing on early voting in some of the critical states. And these stats are through Monday of this week, and it's from states where the data is publicly available. The breakdown of over the 9 million people who asked for ballots in Florida, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Maine, and Iowa, 52% of them are Democrats, 28% of them are Republicans, and 20% are unaffiliated. And there's also Republican and Democratic Party data in the states of Ohio, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Wisconsin. This showing similar trend lines. So it looks as if the Democrats are following through on all the predictions of either early voting or requesting these mail-in ballots. And it's really outpacing and scaring a number of Republican campaign officials, as I've talked to a few of them this week. They've got a lot of ground to make up in the next 30 days. And they're doing that with a president who continues to throw fire on the mail-in ballot, the legitimacy of the mail-in ballot efforts. So the party guys are trying to turn that around. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, well, it's reason to worry by both parties. Yep. I mean, on the one hand, yes, the Republicans are worried that this could be a sign of just tremendous, grassroots support for Democrats. On the other hand, the Democrats are worried a little bit that this may be that it's going to be a sign that the Democrats will be heavily oriented toward the mail-in ballot, some large share of which may be disallowed, right? Not large share, but a significant share. What if it's 1% or 1.5% are disallowed through various technicalities, like in Pennsylvania, the naked ballot, it has to go into a sealed envelope inside another sealed envelope. And if you don't do that, well, the court has ruled that it can be, disallowed. All the various other reasons why they can be disallowed. This may give, Trump another 0.5% edge in the vote. Or more, right, depending on how aggressively the court cases and the various decisions at the state level, which are completely decentralized, disorganized. I mean, every state has different rules, obviously, different laws. But that's going to be a mess. And so that worries Democrats a little bit. Yes, they're happy that there's a big turnout for Democrats, but they're worried that this may indicate that the Republicans will hugely dominate in the in-person vote. And that will have consequences on the first things that people see on election day.
Yeah, and that's the Republicans I talked to this week and last are really banking on trying to utilize and get their voters, especially their senior Republican voters, to utilize the mail-in ballot efforts underway and not sort of lower the temperature But they are counting on a massive turnout operation. They have knocked on millions of doors, as we've all seen in the news cycles here, where the Democrats have been doing their outreach online. So there is a ground game that we've talked about in past elections that the Republicans seem to be confident in on Election Day. Lastly, on the turnout side, the Democrats are also, back to the Democrat favoring the Democrats, they're turning in their ballots at higher rates than Republicans right now as well. Not only are they requesting these and requesting the ballots, they're also turning them in at higher rates, especially in Florida and North Carolina. And that information is publicly available. That data just came out. Lastly, again, one more lastly here, in North Carolina and Georgia, this is something that we're going to have to pay close attention to, Neil, but one in five voters who cast their ballots already didn't vote in 2016. So that we're seeing just a massive increase that we've been predicting and the media has been talking about for months now in participation right now. We are going to pivot to the countdown to chaos.
We've
done a lot of work here in the past couple of weeks and all the scenarios and outcomes as we get closer to Election Day and a lot of potential uncertainty, again, or ambiguity, more uncertainty around the voting, which is becoming clearer, and more ambiguity around the take us through the various scenarios, Neil.
Well, this is where, you know, the pollsters like Nate Silver and, you know, none of the big organizations, they fear to tread, right? I mean, they don't pretend to know the answer to this. They can count. They're very good at statistically estimating the surveys. They can count up the electoral votes. They can do margin of errors in each state. They can do Monte Carlo simulate, right? So all of that. What they can't estimate are the odds that something is going to happen sort of constitutionally or legally to sort of set the count of these electoral votes or to disallow some of these electoral votes in a way which could result in an extraordinary outcome. First of all, just to, you know, kind of take people through a little bit of the, you know, how the sausage is made. A lot of people aren't totally familiar with it, but how we elect the president is in Article 2 of the Constitution. It was amended to the 12th Amendment, basically in 1804, and that's kind of it. I mean, so we've been fixed since then. It was expected by the founding fathers, actually many of them, that most elections would actually be decided in the House of Representatives. The electors would just, you know, choose some of the most viable candidates, and they would choose among the top five in the House of Representatives. Of course, that didn't happen. We had national political parties and a very simple ballot. And most of the states, you know, by the 1830s or 40s, moved toward popular election of electors. But it's interesting to note that that's not in the Constitution. In the Constitution, states can appoint their electors almost any way they want, so long as they have a very fair and clear process for doing it. And actually, there have been instances, even in recent years, when, particularly when new states like Hawaii first came in, they would simply say, we don't have time to do a primary, you know, we don't have time to actually do an election. We're just going to have our state legislature appoint the electors. And that was valid, right? So here's the first point. State legislatures are given by the Constitution a great deal of prerogative, and that's to choose electors according to how they see fit, as long as it's according to the laws that they've legislated. And that's actually came up in the Gore, you know, versus Bush 2 decision in 2000. Basically, the whole issue before the Supreme Court was not who actually won that election in Florida, but rather was Florida actually following precisely its own laws, right? Anyway, all of that was later codified in not a new part of the Constitution, but actually a legislative act called the Electoral Count Act of 1887 that was legislated in the wake of the famous, you know, Tilden Hayes contest in 1876. And it is the way we now go through the process of selecting our president, believe it or not. And it's a It's a huge ramshackle statute. No one is entirely clear exactly how it works. And the reason it's mainly worked is because no one has really contested it. But what's really important about this act, and I'll get to this in just a second, why it's important, is that on December 8th, basically 6 days before the electoral colleges meet in all the various state capitals, there's a kind of a safe harbor day. If a state selects a slate of electors and the government signs it and certifies it by that date, December 8th, it'll be December 8th this year, then it is kind of prima facie, you know, just considered to be legitimate later on when you know, that vote is submitted to Congress. However, if the final decision on the electors can be delayed beyond safe harbor day, then everything is open to challenge on December 6th. And that's what I want to get to. Now, how can this thing be delayed until after December 8th? Well, given the huge volume of mail-in ballots, there may be a number of states that can't get to the safe harbor day just generally, right? You remember that that New York state primary, right, which took 6 weeks, 7 weeks. You remember that? That was in Manhattan. And that was
Carolyn Maloney. Yeah, Trump referenced it the other night. Yeah, Carolyn Maloney.
Right. And so, in other words, you might need no help in order to have many states fail to get to the safe harbor day, or by using courts, you know, constantly challenging with the results, right? You can simply delay and draw out the decision until after safe harbor day. Or failing that, if the Democratic slate is you know, chosen and nominated, you can use the courts to disallow it. Or at least until, again, the safe harbor day. Or alternatively, if you have a Republican legislature, and by the way, every single one of these battleground states has Republican state legislatures, right? Some of them have Democratic governors, but all of them have Republican legislatures, with the partial exception of Minnesota, which is divided. But the point is, the legislature can say, we ultimately have the power in case of impropriety or something about the process is wrong, we suspect fraud or whatever, we have the power to nominate our own or elect our own set of electors. So then you have two slates of electors, right? The Democrats, you know, certify one, the Republicans certify another. All right, so what happens? You got this chaos. Maybe, you know, some are not safe harbor day, and you've got maybe some of them don't. Some states may not have a slate of electors at all. Some states may be submitting two slates of electors. That's what happened in the Hayes-Tilden election. Okay. On January 3rd, a new Congress convenes, and on January 6th, there's a joint session of Congress. Okay, so both the House and the Senate, they get together, and that's where the president of the Senate, that will be Vice President Pence, will start reading formally. It'll be brought to him in a mahogany box, you know, and by that time it'll be certified by the, you know, U.S. National Registrar, and, you know, it will be checked and vetted and so on. And it will be brought, and there will be sealed envelopes, and one by one he will unseal them. Now, any one of those results can be challenged, and only if one representative and one senator present at that assembly objects. And at that point, according to the 1887 Act, this has only rarely happened, but if they do object, then what it specifies is the two houses then separate, they meet separately, and they do their own, you know, vote. It's unclear, you know, whether or not they could interview, you know, testimony, whether they could get people to testify, or how they do fact finding. But in any case, they go and they each make a decision independently of the matter. Now, if they both agree, well, fine. If they disagree, and the slate was submitted by the safe harbor day and was certified by the governor, well, that's deemed to be good in any case, right? But if it's not by the safe harbor day and they disagree, it's very unclear what happens. One reading of the law is that if the governor certifies it, it has to be allowed. But another equally valid reading of the law is it's simply not counted. that slate is simply not counted. Now, you can see where this is going, JT. I mean, if enough slates are not counted, what's going to happen? You can have far fewer than 538 electors ultimately eligible to be counted. And at that point, as long as it's neither side gets a majority of the 538, which is, I believe, is 269, right? Then it seems as though then the election goes to the House of Representatives for a contingent election, right? That's the point. And what happens in a contingent election? Well, it goes to the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives votes by state delegation, right? That's what we brought up, that up. That's a special procedure in the Constitution. They vote by state delegation. D.C. does not count. And it looks as though in a straight-up vote, the Republicans would win, all right? So they would get to choose their own candidate. Now, it's a little bit complicated here. There's a lot of contingencies. For example, if the Democrats win the Senate, then they might control both houses. And in that case, maybe there would be no disagreement about which slate. You know what I mean? When they both in the joint session, when they both go into separate session, they might agree, because by that time the Democrats will have a majority.
Yep.
In which case, there wouldn't be a problem. I think the big incredible scenario would be, what if the Republicans barely manage to keep the Senate, and so then you do get repeated disagreements on the different slates, and then you get this absolutely incredible scenario. Now, what would the House do? I can imagine maybe, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, would simply refuse to convene and simply say, this is unconstitutional. I'm just simply going to refuse to convene. Now, if that happens, there's another provision that comes in, because part of what's written into the new act is that if by January 20th, when a new president is supposed to be inaugurated, right, sworn in, if no decision has been made, then the Secession Act comes into being. The current president is out, and it's Nancy Pelosi who actually becomes interim president in that case.
Yeah.
Now, this is incredible, JJ. I mean, you have to admit, I mean, this whole thing is amazing. Now, she would be president until some procedure is devised for, finalizing the selection process, which by that time, as you can imagine, will be tearing the nation to pieces. You'll probably have, demonstrations on the streets. I mean, can you imagine, JT, that the state of the country under this kind
stock
of
market.
Under this kind of scenario?
Stock market would crash.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they would crash as soon as they begin to see that it's really beginning to influence, political stability, and you get such an enormous volatility of possible outcomes, some of which might be not entirely, some of which may be, illiberal and undemocratic, simply because people just want anything to quell disorder and. And to some extent, there may be players in this who want that. So anyway, that's the scenario. I do think that one of the most ominous things about the debate to me was Trump seems to be paving the way for that scenario by repeatedly saying that fraud is everywhere. And if I'm not elected, I'll just, suspect that there has been massive fraud, and I will do everything I can to disallow a lot of these state results. I don't know about you, JT, but I strongly got the impression that he was sort of laying the ground for that.
Oh, he has been, and that was just cemented on Tuesday night when, most pundits are talking about weeks, and he's now talking months, which means that he has a plan in his head. And, if there's one thing about the guy, he when it comes to stuff like this, he follows through with it. So we know that they're planning on, we're already seeing a massive number of lawsuits. And we talked about this last time. This is going to be the topic of our next call, a massive number of election related lawsuits in 44 states, over, I think, 307 lawsuits. 200 of those lawsuits are just about ballots themselves. This is going to be
totally. And this brings up, by the way, the importance of this composition of the Supreme Court. A lot of these cases, because people have to decide, right? This is urgent. So this goes on to the shadow docket of the Supreme Court. It doesn't have to wait for the usual waiting line, right? It is immediately decided. The Supreme Court does not have to actually issue a written opinion. It just decides these things. And in that case, you can see why having a 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court might help. I don't think it's so much that Justice Roberts is suspected of necessarily, being unreliable or, people talking about it. I just think it's like the Supreme Court, particularly the Chief Justice, does not like 5-4 decisions that upset things. But if a 6-3 decision, well, then, even he might join the decision. And so this is important. And by the way, one last thing is interesting to consider. This ramshackle Electoral Count Act of 1887, which no one can quite agree on how to interpret its various clauses, is just going to be ripe for all kinds of interpretive questions that go right to the Supreme Court. Many legal scholars believe the Electoral Count Act is in itself unconstitutional. And the reason is because it seems to bind the two houses to specific procedures to act. Now, if there's one very fundamental kind of constitutional doctrine, it's that no Congress, no House, no Senate can bind future houses to follow any specific procedure, whether it's filibuster or anything else, right? I mean, any future yep. House or Senate can change their own procedure. You can't bind a future Congress unless you have a constitutional amendment, right? It's very unclear how binding the Electoral Count Act is and whether or not, Congress could, jointly or separately decide to violate it and claim that the act itself was unconstitutional and what it forced it to do. That, as you're beginning to see, there are just all kinds of places in here for escape hatches and end runs and various kinds of interpretation, things which could go to the Supreme Court. And then, of course, the question is whether people would, go along with the Supreme Court decision, I guess, in extremis.
Yep. Just a sidebar, and I mentioned Pelosi trying to expand the House map. She also over the weekend sort of informed them that this could be a potential scenario. So with the focus on the Electoral College, it looks as if the Democrats are going to try to win. This is kind of, I don't want to say it's out of reach, but states like Montana and Alaska, which are Republican states, where Democrats have been competitive recently, but they're generally Republican states, but a Democrat victory by just one seat could flip that whole delegation. So, right. Democrats are certainly focused on it. The Republicans, as we know, have an army. Both sides have armies of lawyers ready to go. But now, Pelosi sees that this is a potential happening in the House and diverting resources there too.
I think another big win for the Democrats is if they can take the Senate. And by the way, another question we haven't even considered is that many of the new Senate senators and House members themselves, their election may not have been determined yet.
Yep.
So, consider yeah. that, right? You have this new Congress meeting and many of them may not have their credentials yet. Many
right.
of you may have empty seats. What about Georgia, right?
Yeah, we're still thinking that a special election is until January 4th or 5th, and if the House
it's
and Senate can be on January
on
6th,
Senate.
Yeah. And
there's no way they're going to get their credentials by then. So does the Republican governor in that case quickly appoint an interim to simply fill the spot for a few days while the joint session meets? It's an amazing, you know, the scenarios here are sort of disorienting to think through them all.
So we actually have time for questions. Last time we did a longer presentation, but wanted to leave time for questions. And the first one out of the hopper, I think, is for both of us, is please discuss the debate, the impact of the debate on Tuesday night on Trump and Biden's chances, and again on the Republicans taking over the Senate, not keeping the Senate. You want to take that first, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it hurt Trump. No question about it. I think it was a very bad look for Trump, particularly to the extent there are undecided voters. I don't think it was a good look. I don't think I don't think that came across as, you know, an attractive, you know, side to him. I also think that it may actually convince some Trump voters probably not to vote for Biden. I think a lot of Trump voters would never vote for Biden, but maybe just to stay home.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another danger. You also just cool the ardor, you know, not of your core, you know, not of Trump's tribe. I mean, they'll come out in any case. But I think a lot of people might decide, you know, maybe I can't bring myself to vote for Joe Biden, but maybe I just don't do anything that day.
Yeah, and I think it has more of I do think that it impacts the race, as you're saying. I'm not certain that some of those undecideds have convincingly moved to Biden, but they're definitely going to give him a second look after that. But I think there's also, in talking to Senate Republicans, I think there's also on Capitol Hill concern that, you know, they wanted to be talking about Amy Coney Barrett yesterday and today, as she's making her rounds on Capitol Hill. And all they've been doing for the last 48 hours is answering questions about Trump's debate performance. And more importantly, his failure to address the white supremacy issue. So I think that it may have more of an impact on the Senate than we're thinking, because now, instead of spending time on the Supreme Court and things they want to be talking about, whether it's here in Washington or when they go back home, they're going to have to answer. And they've done it artfully, for the most part, I say that loosely, over the past 4 years and sort of evaded some of these questions. But now it's like, do you embrace what Trump said about or didn't say about white supremacists? So it may haunt them on the campaign trail. They want to be talking about anything but that right now. And that's going to be the focus. Every time they have momentum behind them, such as the Supreme Court the new nominee they have, it feels as if Trump sort of takes that steam away from them. So I think it's going to
I always thought that, you know, from a long-term perspective, you know, for the conservative voter, I mean, having the Barrett, you know, confirmed before the election is probably what they want. On the other hand, if Trump wants to get, you know, more votes on election day, you know, waiting until just after the election might be better, because there's the old adage, you know, voters never thank people for what they've done. They always turn out for what they think their leader is about to do. And a lot of people might think, well, he's put in this one more Supreme Court justice, fine. Now I really don't care what happens to him at that point.
Democrats in a bit of a bind. I mean, they do want to delay this or stall the nomination as long as possible. But you know what, you get too close to the election, then I think it does impact Republicans. So they're sort of in a, as I said, they're in a bind whether or not to just completely throw up roadblocks. And there are only limited roadblocks. Eventually, Barrett will get through. There's almost no doubt, unless there's some unforeseen circumstance that we're not taking into consideration right now. So they're in a bit of a dilemma. So I would getting confirmed before election day, though.
I would add, too, just on this whole, you know, the kind of the nightmare constitutional scenario. This only comes into play if it's a close election. I know I've said that before, but, you know, the spectrum of outcomes to me is On the one hand, Biden wins a pretty decisive victory, even on election day in many of the battleground states. It's clear where this is going. And then in that case, you know, I think most of the uncertainty is really quite quickly removed.
I agree.
I think is concerning is we're at the other end of the probability spectrum. It's a very close race, close enough that in many of these battleground states, you could plausibly claim, well, who knows what nefarious practices and voter fraud might have done, and you know, we need to recount, and you tie up everything. I think to me that's what Trump, I think, as far as I see, that's kind of what he's preparing for. He's kind of preparing for that scenario.
Yeah, and the states to watch. I mean, Florida, it looks as if when we talk about these battleground states, Florida has voted absentee and have, you know, they've got this, right? And it looks as if they'll have their count in on election night. So I'm not, again, if Florida goes one way or the other, then we're either in for a short night or a long night. The other state is, I think Arizona could be a little longer. They have an infrastructure in place to do the vote by mail, but they're estimating that it could take a few extra days. But I think the states to watch, as we all know, are Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, because those three states, the other battleground states may have issues, but it seems as if they have practice here. They've got a track record. These other three states, whether they have lawsuits pending or other clouds looming, they can't start counting ballots until election night. So,
right
between
So
those are the three to watch.
Michigan and Pennsylvania, especially. So.
Michigan is yes. Question: if Trump loses, what direction ideologically will the Republican Party take? What if Biden loses and the Democrats? I'll do the easy one first. If Biden loses, I think the Democrats take a massive leftward lurch, and the progressives make a big play to, I don't want to say topple Pelosi, but take over the House, or at least have a larger role in the House. I think the progressive agenda becomes the centerpiece, you know, the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, that becomes a clarion call for the Democrats. The Republicans, I'm not so sure. It feels like there's going to be, you know, you've got this the conservatives who are all kind of all over the map with Trump. You've got the anti-Trumpers, you've got the Lincoln Project, all these various and disparate entities out there. So you have a conservative base that will, I think, revive itself somehow, but then you've got this Trump base that doesn't typically correlate with the traditional Republican base. So I don't know if it splits into two parties or what. Any thoughts there? I've been asked this question before. I'm stumped by that one.
Well, you've got tremendous strains within each party, right? And those strains always, become visible after a defeat. So obviously, with the Democrats, it's the young, kind of left-shifted, millennial leadership to the extent that it's already rising in that group. And then, as we've often discussed, there's a bifurcated age distribution among the Democrats in Congress. You don't have a lot of Xers, but then you have a lot of, like, early boomers and silence. You have a much older, progressive, conventionally liberal leadership, obviously, which Pelosi is a leader, and so you ever really, that begins to break down. And you're right; probably the younger ones would have a much greater role. I think, on the other hand, it's harder to say with Trump, because you're going to have a big war between the old establishment Republicans. Yeah. And the libertarians, tea parties, and populists. I mean, the core of the Trump populist movement, and that's kind of harder to see. I mean, we saw a lot of them run in 2016, right? These are the, Marco Rubios and Ted Cruz's, and I mean, we kind of know who the next generation of leadership is. These are all the Xers, which have been eclipsed, right? Yep. Yeah, and these are all the, by the way, these are all born in the 1960s. These are kind of, they voted, you know, first votes for Reagan in the 80s. This is a heavily Republican cohort of Americans, and this is their moment, right? This will be their opportunity with Trump out of the way, that last kind of, you know, baby boomer out of the way for this new generation to take over. They're going to be a lot more pragmatic and in some ways a lot more conventionally conservative, but hopefully, you know, they'll do everything they can to retain that populist edge. Typically, you know, losing is devastating for a party, but it actually leads to improvements. But it all depends on what the party in power then does, right? So dysfunction of the party in power can actually make the party out of power, you know, behave even worse. So I've always had the adage that excellence in one party tends to encourage the other party to become a better party in order to compete. And likewise, there's also competition for the bottom as well.
Yep. I've got another question, but before I ask this one, just remind our listeners, you could send us questions to qa@hedgeye.com. This might be the last one, Neil. Does high unemployment in a state like Pennsylvania help Biden? I think the national average is 8.4. Pennsylvania is 10.3, as I'm looking it up right now. Michigan, 8.7. I think where you have unemployment higher than a national, yeah, it's going to be a problem, I think, for Trump in those states. And I definitely think that it helps Biden. Again, especially in those three battleground states. Florida is 7.4%, North Carolina 6.5%, Arizona 5.9%, and Wisconsin 6.2%. So, yeah, I certainly think high unemployment is going to help, not going to help the incumbent in this case. And I think have another – good.
I would say I think that economic issues have recently had a declining effect on people's vote, because they're so ideologically polarized that they interpret economic events completely differently. I mean, if you were to interview Republicans now, they think the economy is doing really well. And similarly, in the late years of the Obama administration, you know, Democrats thought the economy was great. You know, Republicans thought it was terrible. As soon as Trump was elected, there's a complete switching of positions on where they thought the economy was, right? So, in other words, there is a narrative for Republicans on how the economy is not too bad after all, and there's a narrative for Democrats. I don't know how much, again, there's so few undecideds here. I think what's going to be more important, rather than changes in the unemployment rate, is what's going to happen at the pandemic. You know, we've been waiting for signs of an uptick. You know, we've already seen an uptick in the case rate. If we start seeing a significant uptick in death rates, particularly in some of the battleground states, that's going to be more important. Remember that we're headed into a season that's colder, drier weather, more people indoors, more people, you know, prone to those super spreader events. And to me, that's going to figure more heavily in, you know, issues of turnout. That could work. I mean, it's interesting whose party that would benefit. Obviously, you'd think that maybe the people who tend to show up in person might be dissuaded. Maybe not. Clearly, it won't influence mail-in ballot very much. But to me, that would be a very interesting one to watch in some of these, you know, and many of these battleground states are in northern areas where it does get cold and dry pretty soon.
Yeah, and something else to watch, sort of a sidebar here, is the younger voters, whether they're Democrat or Republican. As I was looking at the early return stats that I was citing earlier, I was trying to find some data on how younger voters were voting. And it seems as if some of them on the Democratic side are requesting ballots or early voting, but some of them are choosing potentially to vote closer to Election Day. So I don't know if that might be a good thing for us to look at in the next couple of weeks. We are going to do another call in very short order, as our colleague Paul Glencher, who is a legal policy analyst as well as our tech analyst and a member of the Supreme Court bar is looking at a case potentially before the Supreme Court dealing with Pennsylvania ballots the Pennsylvania legislature has appealed to the Supreme Court. So that we'll know any day now whether or not the Supreme Court of the United States will take up that Pennsylvania case. So we are going to resume this series between Neil and myself and add in Paul Glencher in the next week, in the next 2 weeks, I should say, talk a little bit more about the courts, potential outcomes there, other legislation or, I'm sorry, other litigation we're seeing and other scenarios that Neil uncovers between now and, of course, Election Day. So stay tuned for that. And also next week, Michael Bloom and I will be back on video talking about how COVID is impacting countries across the Atlantic and the Pacific. So we're going to be looking at various scenarios of reopening, levels of scenarios and waves. And stay tuned for that invite that's coming. Neil, any final words?
No, I think that's it. Obviously, COVID is rising again to the top of my radar screen. We're going to have probably more COVID reports coming in the fall. And as you just alluded to, we now have a second wave in place in Europe. I just understood last night that Madrid decided to shut down, go into shutdown mode again. So, you know, this is having an impact on the economy, and it could still have an impact on the election.
Yep. Neil, that's great. Great as always. Good doing this with you, and we're actually having a little bit of fun doing this. So stay tuned for our next appearance with Paul Glencher coming soon. And thank you, everyone, for dialing in.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.